From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a concert and interview with the jazz pianist and composer Dave Burrell. He first became known in the 60s as part of the jazz avant-garde, but he's also explored early jazz, and you can hear the influence of Jelly Roll Morton and stride pianists in his playing. He's recorded with Pharoah Sanders, performed jazz arrangements of Puccini, and composed an opera about growing up in Hawaii. Also, actress Goldie Hawn on her two images in Hollywood, the ditzy, giggly, wide-eyed girl, and the powerful actress and producer who made the cover of Time after Private Benjamin. She has a new autobiography. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The last time I heard pianist and composer Dave Burrell perform solo, all I could think of was, we have to get him to play on our show. Well, today is that day. In the late 60s, Burrell was one of the mavericks of the jazz avant-garde. He's recorded with Archie Shepp and Pharoah Sanders. But he also loves early jazz styles. As our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has said, Burrell mixes the antique and the modern with a naturalness recalling Earl Hines, Monk, and Sun Ra. Like them, he evokes more than recreates early jazz styles. Burrell combines an avant-garde pianist's love of density with a buoyant, old-timey sense of rhythm. Gary Giddens has called Burrell a scintillating solo performer. Thurston Moore of the band Sonic Youth put Burrell's album Echoes in the number one slot on his list of the top 10 free jazz underground recordings. Burrell grew up in Middletown, Ohio, Harlem, and Hawaii. When his family moved to Hawaii after World War II, they were among the few African-American families there. Dave Burrell's latest CD is called Expansion, and it features his group, the Full Blown Trio, drummer Andrew Cyril and bass player William Parker. Dave Burrell, welcome to Fresh Air. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time, so
thanks.
Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a song that's on your new CD that I'd love you to start with. I've also heard you perform it in concert. It's a real treat. This is your reworking of the Irving Berlin song, They Say That Falling in Love is Wonderful. Would you do it for us?
Sure.
Wonderful. I love the way you do that. You know, one of the things I just particularly love about your playing is that some of it's really rooted in the very early days of jazz. Ragtime, Jelly Roll Morton. At the same time, you've played a lot of free jazz. You're an avant-gardist. And the two kind of come together and meet in the middle in your playing. You're drawing on both ends, plus on the whole kind of history of American popular song. And I love the way you've kind of fallen in love with both historical ends and incorporated it for your own means.
Right. Thanks. I didn't really start off for it to be that way. I think that I was caught up in the avant-garde or free jazz movement in the mid-60s in New York, and I was still working on becoming a firmly rooted traditionalist. The players around me that I really respected were interested in both as well. John Coltrane was just departing from tradition and had really validated for all of us colleagues that it was okay if you had a firm tradition, a solid foundation, that you could go ahead and explore other ways of hearing, other ways of soloing, painting.
When did you start listening to and playing the music of Jelly Roll Morton?
I started when producer, historian Sam Charters did a public radio show in the late 80s. And he said to me that he heard in my playing what he heard in Morton's. And I wanted to know exactly what that was. And he told me that they were getting ready to do a special on the bicentennial of Morton's life, and he wanted me to be a part of it.
So you had to learn the music.
I did. And I thought it was easy. I went to Patelson's and bought the book, and Monica said, "Could you play this?" It was a phone book. And I said, "Sure." And she said, "Let me hear one of them." And it was a disaster. And so I told Sam, "I'm not going to be ready by the deadline." And he said, "Oh, of course you will." And then he took me in the studio maybe a month later, and I did sort of squeak by with some of the stuff, and I fell in love with it. I felt that it was just what I needed to go to at that time.
Well, a few years after that, you recorded an album that was Jelly Roll Morton compositions and some originals in that vein. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to play a Jelly Roll Morton composition for us now, and this is The Crave. Do you want to say anything about it before you play it?
Yes, The Crave is one of the most significant of all of his rags because it has the Spanish tinge, which is bum, 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 bum. And that ingredient at the time, Morton, when I heard him talk to Alan Lomax at the Smithsonian, he said to Lomax that that ingredient was a very necessary part of the jazz of his era to be included.
So this is Dave Burrell at the piano playing Jelly Roll Morton's The Crave.
Thank you.
Dave Burrell playing Jaleel Morton's The Crave. And Dave Burrell has a new CD with his group, The Full Blown Trio, and it's called Expansion. Could you illustrate a little bit what's happening in The Crave that we just heard? What makes that Jaleel Morton?
Yeah. Matilda bass line is evident, the Caribbean influence in this last strain. So it gets as folky as you can imagine, and that's so very rare for the very first jazz composition to be written down and to have the European ingredients, because of course he studied with European teachers. He has the sort of the neighborhood sound, he has a sophisticated technique, and yet he has the street sound of the brothel.
You had already played a lot of free jazz and avant-garde jazz before playing Jaleel Morton. Were there things in the Morton compositions that struck you as being almost avant-garde in some way? Do you know what I mean? Of being much more modern than you would have thought they could have been in the 1920s.
Yes, yes. Bass lines that are so very syncopated that they're timeless, and it doesn't matter what you attach them to. You could have a Morton-inspired bass line at this release point, for example, on The Crave. That note at the end, it's just sort of shoved into the ensemble of notes as an intrusive pedal point sound, which has just sort of been mimicked throughout the decades. And it still doesn't have a rival as far as the effectiveness that it brings to the composition swing. The rest of the release of the piece, I'll demonstrate now how it sort of flowers out and ends, and the tension is released. So
to learn?
Yeah, it was for me. I don't think that anyone really has difficulty with the notes, because they call it third grade classical music, they compare it to. But what it needs is a lot of strength, and it needs a lot of thrust to enable to execute the syncopation.
My guest is Dave Burrell. His latest CD is called Expansion. We'll hear more of his concert and interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dave Burrell, and he's a pianist and composer based in Philadelphia, but he spends a lot of the year traveling around the world performing. He has a recent CD, which is called Expansion, and it features his group, The Full Blown Trio. When you were playing free jazz, I mean, you came to New York in the 60s?
65.
And you were playing free jazz. You were playing with people like Ornette Coleman, Marion Brown, Pharoah Sanders. And was it hard to find a place for yourself in free jazz as a pianist? Sure, there's Cecil Taylor, But Ornette Coleman, for instance, didn't have a piano in his group, and I think a lot of free jazz players might have felt that, you know, piano just harmonically didn't belong.
That's correct. That's what most everybody said, and the piano players had to figure out how to not disturb this new trend. And so what I started doing was learning the melodies, and I'd play along with the horns, and I wouldn't play any chords. And so I became a horn myself. And if it was a short, snappy head like, then I was out, and the horn went on to solo with the bass and drum. And then later on, the horn soloist, frontline people would turn around to me, and they didn't want chords. They wanted color and rhythm from me. So I had to play clusters that sounded in the idiom of where the melody and the solo, where it had come to, with something like a cluster like what I just played, wouldn't disturb it. So maybe the horn player is up here. And I just went. So that was working sometimes. I think that the most difficult part was the horn players were just figuring out how to become very energetic and not play within some box or some framework. So you can imagine someone just taking a motif and arguing the motif as vigorously as they chose, and the pianist going. So the drums and the rhythm section are all doing a chant that stays the same. The horns, however, are leaving the immediate premise.
Was it ever frustrating? Here's this like free jazz, and the horns are being like liberated to scream and do whatever they want. But you, as the pianist, are kind of boxed in. You know, they don't want chords. You're doing like clusters. You're doing this repetitive line underneath them.
Right.
So it wasn't, sounds like it wasn't that liberating for you.
It wasn't that liberating, but it was challenging. And then later, after we heard back what we had, for example, with this Upper and Lower Egypt motif that Pharoah Saunders wrote that I just played, when we did that in Rudy Van Gelder's studio in New Jersey, Bob Thiel was producing, he said, well, that's a great formula. You just have the chant, the rhythm section is blocking along, and you have all of this wild freedom on the front line. And then later, the pianist can go ahead and take his solo while everybody else sleeps.
And not the audience.
Yeah. No, not the audience. So then I thought, oh my goodness, now it's my turn. Now what am I going to do? And I had to figure out some other stuff to do.
So what did you do?
I did have an interlude function that became very necessary because everybody was exhausted anyway. And I was going deaf from cymbals in my ear.
We'll continue our performance by Dave Burrell in the second half of the show. His latest CD, which features Andrew Surreal and William Parker, is called Expansion. Here's Burrell with Pharoah Saunders, recorded in 1966. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin. Available in stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Dialogues by Stephen Spignesi, a novel in conversations between an accused murderer and her court-appointed psychiatrist. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our concert and interview with pianist Dave Burrell. Also, Goldie Hawn on turning the ditzy girl from Laugh-In into a powerful actress and producer. She has a new autobiography. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our concert and interview with composer and pianist Dave Burrell. His latest CD is called Expansion. Burrell's music draws on both ends of jazz history, its early roots and its avant-garde. When we left off, we were talking about his life in the 60s, when he was part of the free jazz scene in New York. At the same time that you were, you know, playing all this free jazz in concert, would you go home and then try to learn, like, Scott Joplin rags? Because that has been such a fundamental part of who you are.
Yes, in the back of our minds, most of the innovators knew what Coltrane had done, and I think that he was the leader of being able to say, well, I departed after I thoroughly explored the so-called inside, and I wrote Giant Steps, and I feel now that I must move on to not only into atonal music, but to modes and other approaches. And I have my credentials in order. That's Mr. Coltrane talking. And I think everybody else in the jazz community would agree.
Now, I think, tell me if this is right, that John Coltrane's Giant Steps is based on an exercise?
Yeah, it is based on a chord progression that has been taken after its initial that chord progression has a linkage that takes it to an identical chord progression in another key. It's something that he put together. He got a motif probably from a book like Nicholas Lanevsky's. You could call it an etude, like a Chopin etude, to get better in scurrying around different chord changes for him personally.
Now, Giant Steps, a lot of horn players have played that, and it's, I think, usually a horn musician's, you know, tune. You do it on piano. You have like a stride piano version of Giant Steps. Would you play it for us?
Sure.
And this is Dave Burrell at the piano. ¶¶ When I listen to you play, I think how strong your fingers are.
Well, a lot of the avant-garde pianists, from having to keep up with drummers that were so strong, like Elvin Jones and Andrew Surreal, even Philly Joe, not to mention Max Roach, but in order to say, be there in and be heard and be in the mix, you found that you played a lot harder than you thought you could. And oftentimes, when the ensemble was finished and they had played for an hour, they would want a piano solo. So you would have to keep playing.
You know, tendonitis is such a problem for a lot of musicians, particularly pianists. So when you're playing with that kind of finger strength all the time, and volume and that percussive quality become really important, are you putting your fingers at risk?
I think so. I think that you develop a technique that's kind of like a beat up boxer's technique. You can still go in the ring and throw one, but maybe he's been hurt. I know I've taped my fingers and I've nicked them on ivory that was not smooth, and not been able to play because I ripped off a nail or something. Especially 20 years ago, when trying to just be as aggressive, say, as Cecil Taylor.
You grew up from the age of 6 till you were a young adult in Hawaii.
Right.
Your parents are from the States.
Right.
How did they end up with you in Hawaii?
Well, we were the first African-American family outside of the military to settle there. And it happened right after World War II.
To settle in Hawaii or just in Honolulu?
To settle in Hawaii, as far as we know.
Wow.
And it was great for me because I met people from all over the world. We were at a settlement called Palama Settlement in Kalihi. And at that time, it was a post-war recreation, art, and cultural center that my mom taught piano lessons, where she taught piano lessons. And my dad was doing his thesis on, he's a sociologist, just passed away at 91, about Hawaii being the melting pot of the Pacific.
Was growing up in Hawaii a good experience?
It was an incredibly good experience. And what ultimately I ended up doing was having a rhythm and blues band, and I was on television every Saturday afternoon.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, what a media family, because your mother did a jazz radio show in Hawaii,
right?
Yeah,
she had a radio show in Waikiki, and I was on TV, and I played at the military bases, too.
You've talked about some of the many elements that have gone into your music. Did you hear a lot of traditional Hawaiian music growing up in Hawaii, and did that have an impact on your own composition?
I did.
Could you just play a few bars of one of those Hawaiian-influenced pieces?
Sure.
Dave Varell, it's just been great talking with you and hearing you play. I'm so glad we did this. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
pianist and composer Dave Burrell recorded in our studio. He lives in Philadelphia, but spends a lot of time performing around the world. In fact, tonight he leaves for Rome. The final piece he played for us is from an opera he's composed based on his experiences coming of age in Hawaii. He hopes to find the backing to stage it. Burrell's Fresh Air performance was recorded by Audrey Bentham. Coming up, Goldie Hawn. She has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air. Goldie Hawn first became famous for her performances on the TV series Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, where she was often covered in body paint and almost always not very bright.
Goldie, you'd be the one to ask about this. You know a lot
of
people.
Yes, I know a lot of things.
Yes, I know. And I appreciate your telling me about them. You know, but
yes.
What do you think about this? A lot of people think that the country is becoming polarized.
That now, Dan,
no,
that is ridiculous.
Is
because
it?
The world, how can they make us going to make us Polish?
I know.
After Laugh-In, Goldie Hawn went on to star in such films as Shampoo, Foul Play, Private Benjamin, Swing Shift, Overboard, The First Wives Club, and The Banger Sisters. She won an Oscar for her first film, Cactus Flower. Among the things she's now famous for is being the mother of Kate Hudson. Goldie Hawn has written a memoir called A Lotus Grows in the Mud. What I used to hear about you years ago when you were still playing a lot of characters who were kind of ditzy was that she may play stupid in movies, but she's really smart. And one of the films that helped get that across was Private Benjamin, which you were in on right from the start. You helped get that film made. Now, the premise of this film is that, you know, you're a young woman who gets married to Albert Brooks.
Albert.
And on your wedding night, you're making love. He has a heart attack and just drops dead. And you you have no idea what your place in the world is after that. And you meet a recruiter. He pitches you this kind of fantasy idea of what the army might be. You enlist and find out it's not what you expected and you really hate it. Here's a scene where you're marching around in the pouring rain with other women from the platoon.
My name is Judy, J-U-D-Y, Judy, and I'd like somebody to call me by my name.
Hey, Judy.
Oh, okay, I took my life in my own hands. I made a mistake. Fine, I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. I want to wear my sandals, and I want to go out to lunch. I want to be normal again.
Would you please just shut up, Benjamin? God. Never in all my born days met such a whiny candy ass as you.
I don't want to be in the army. I don't want to be in the army. Don't want to be in the army.
Goldie Hawn in a scene from Private Benjamin. Goldie Hawn, this movie landed you on the cover of Newsweek. What was the gist of the article?
The article really was sort of celebrating my dumb as a fox personality, the fact that I was one of the first, you know, movie stars who was female to carry a movie, to make that kind of money and be that successful, that I produced, and suddenly I turned into kind of a mogul. And the mogul aspect of my career was just sort of made up, but it did shape perception of other people. So it was a double-edged sword, really, and I do address that as well, because it was a turning point in my life. Private Benjamin came at a time when I was married, and my marriage was shaky, and my success didn't help that. And you know, the only thing that you know about fearing success is the actual what success will do to the people around you, and it wasn't easy. I mean, you don't blame everything on a certain circumstance, but I do know that success for women, in particular, who really do have, especially my personality, is I'm very much home, I'm very much a nurturer, I'm very much a mother. I really want to be everything to everyone. And my career, which was just sort of you know, growing just out of, for leaps and bounds and out of my control, really, weighed heavily upon my personal life.
How do you think being successful hurt your marriage?
How do you think it would? I think it's sort of understood, and that is that, you know, one person is more successful than the other, especially female. It's not always easy.
Mm-hmm. You think that this movie might have hurt you in some ways by inflating your image and actually making it difficult for you to be hired as just an actress because the word went out that you want to produce and not just star in something. So can you talk a little bit more about the downside you think that your success in this movie had professionally?
Yeah, the downsides were that, you know, people were thinking that I wanted to control everything and that, you know, that's who they'd be working with. And keeping in mind the time of Private Benjamin was 1980, there weren't too many female producers out there, and there certainly weren't too many people calling the shots. And if they, a female, and if they did, they were aggressive, they were a force to be reckoned with, their power did not necessarily sit well with the male contingency. So I found that I was sort of doing all my own stuff and wishing that a really great director would come my way and, you know, sweep me off my feet like Hopalong Cassidy did in my fantasy when I was a little girl and make everything all right.
Did it happen?
I worked with some good directors. Yeah, it did upon occasion. But, you know, that's what happened, and lots of things change. Success is an interesting catalyst to learning, really.
Well, in your memoir, you point out that early in your career, when your image in the film was of, you know, not being very bright, mm-hmm. that some people thought that your characters are almost like a setback for the women's movement. And of course, then in the mm-hmm. Private Benjamin era, suddenly you were, you know, more of a role model of like women taking power in Hollywood and asserting themselves. So I'm wondering, having during different parts of your career represented two different facets,
you know,
of women's assertiveness, like what does the women's movement actually mean for you?
Oh, it, you know, I was never involved in any movement, you know, so I just sort of, you know, the greatest movement of all for me was the movement of just becoming. And we do that through different periods of our lives, you know. What are we becoming? Who am I? I never looked at a movement other than what it was, and they're very important. Movements are important. The people that head up movements are sometimes fairly radical. Not necessarily who I would align myself with, but we do have to have those radical people in order to, you know, sort of blaze the trail. And I've blazed a few trails in my life, but my radicalism is not about anger or discontentment. It was just sort of a path I took that I felt was the most practical. And, of course, it ended up being something that no women had done, and how did you do this, and you were so brave. Well, for me, it was just about a practical approach to movie making. So being in a movement or being part of a movement, I honor and respect those that do that. But I didn't align myself with any movement.
When you made Private Benjamin, there were still very few women in positions of power in Hollywood, outside of acting power. And that's changed a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. So do you think that the fact that there are many more women in, you know, in positions of power in studios, many more women producers, has it really changed anything fundamentally in terms of the stories being told in movies or the roles that are available for actresses?
No, it has not helped one bit. Not really. I think that the fact that it's like anything else, when a woman gets into a position of power, she wants to hold on to it. So you have to play the game, and it's a man's game. It is still a man's game. And I'll tell you why, and this is the smart part. Men, young men, drive the economics of the movie industry. They go to the movies. They go to the movies that make the money, big money. Unfortunately, What they're not seeing is that there's a very unserved constituency that is completely without movies to see, which is hence why First Wives Club was so huge. So the problem is the writing. The second problem is the men, and by the way, at this point in time, they're quite young men who are, you know, in positions of sort of, you know, associate producers or people who are head of production or assistant heads of production, people who are funneling the material to the higher-ups, who, by the way, these higher-ups don't make movies either. They're usually just business people. So they just find out what's going to make money. And a woman's movie is very hard to get made, very hard. If you make a woman's movie today and it flops, that's a bad thing, because it's not going to be easy to get a movie made for women, particularly on whatever subject it might be. If it's mothers and daughters and a mother-daughter movie comes out and it fails, it's going to be a long time before you get another mother-daughter movie out there.
My guest is Goldie Hawn. Her new memoir is called A Lotus Grows in the Mud. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Goldie Hawn. She's written a new memoir called A Lotus Grows in the Mud. Early in your life, you thought you would become a dancer, and ballet was at the center of your life when you were a child. Your mother was a dance teacher.
No, my mother wasn't. My mother ran the dancing school. My mother was a businesswoman.
Oh.
My aunt was the dancer. Aunt Roberta, she taught me to dance. They were best friends. My mother literally started the business. She ran it. She sat in the front office. She counted the bucks.
So do you think it was any harder or easier to be taught by your aunt than it would have by just somebody who was a teacher who wasn't part of your family?
No. Didn't make any difference to me. I was three.
Right.
It's part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't even remember, you know, never having her. She taught me all the way till I was 19. And by the way, that is the most important thing, looking back on me as I write in my book about dancing and what it does to me and how important and what a great teacher it is. Those dancing years developed my character as much as being the daughter of my two parents, because it taught me how to work, how to break myself down, how to learn to turn myself, how to be hard on myself, how to sweat and lose my breath and try again and again and again until I got it right. That was my teacher.
One of your early jobs, I think, was working as a go-go dancer, dancing on a table.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I tell you, what a time in my life. I mean, the things that we do in order to survive, you know, at least I was moving my feet. But it was pretty horrible. There's a lot of men around there who exposed themselves and did some pretty raunchy things. It was pretty awful. Stuff I didn't tell mommy about, and really not my dad.
If this was like 30 years later, would it have been pole dancing, or is it more of a...
I don't know. You tell me. You know where the world's going today. I mean, God knows I could have been more than pole dancing. Could have been lap dancing for all I know.
Right.
But the reality is I was a dancer, and it's what I did every day, and I just did that on weekends to make some money.
What would you wear?
Fishnet tights and leotards and fringe, high-heeled shoes.
Not go-go boots?
yeah, it's funny. I'm trying to think about that. I think I did have a pair of go-go boots at some point. Absolutely. I forgot about that.
And what did you dance to? What were the records?
Hang On, Sloopy, Twist and Shout, did some Bob Dylan stuff. And, of course, I had one horrible, horrible story, which I share, that I danced all night to Dean Martin, Everybody Loves Somebody Sometimes. I said, how am I going to dance to this? Some guy yells, put another quarter in and make her dance. Oh, how I ever came out loving men.
So how did you dance to Dean Martin?
It's very slowly.
Let me ask you about your name. Your name, Goldie. When I first started seeing you on television and in the movies... Mm-hmm. I thought that Goldie must be maybe even like a nickname because you had blonde hair or because, you know, a golden personality mm-hmm. or something like that. But
sure.
Then, of course, there's also the kind of Goldie from Fiddler on the Roof, a kind of, you know, Jewish name that somebody who was more from the turn of the century was likely to have.
Sure,
so,
sure.
What are the roots of your Goldie?
I was named after my great aunt who raised my mother. My grandmother, my mother's mother, died when she was 3. And she went over to live with my Aunt Goldie, who had subsequently 7 children of her own. So when I was born, Tante Goldie had died a year before I was born. So in the Jewish religion, you really don't want a name after the living. So I got her name. And it was a really cool name to get. And I was bald, so nobody knew what my hair color was for almost 2 years.
You were bald for almost 2 years?
I was. I didn't have much hair.
It's a long time. Writing a memoir is an interesting exercise in the sense that you have to take stock of your life and literally give it shape. Figure out what is the narrative thread that runs through your life. Do you feel like you learned something about yourself in doing this book?
No. No, I only helped share what I did learn.
Well, I should mention, you've been in analysis
learning.
For years, so you've probably already gone through your story.
Exactly. And I don't really... you know, a lot of this stuff is the reason I'm able to impart whatever it is my perceptions are is that I've thought a lot about it.
Goldie Hawn, thank you so much for talking with us.
I like this day.
Goldie Hawn's new memoir is called A Lotus Grows in the Mud.
Everybody loves somebody sometimes.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Everybody find somebody someplace. There's no telling.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Meg Wolitzer talks about her new novel, The Position. It's about a couple who, in the 1970s, writes a joy of sex-type book featuring illustrations of them making love. The Position follows how this sex book affects their lives and the lives of their children. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.